American politics seemed sufficiently combustible even before the images and stories of immigrant children being separated from their parents pushed our temperature even higher. Today's guest argues the superheated politics of 2018 are a reflection of the death of the GOP as a moderate governing party. He's Jay Bookman this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to understand the stories that shape politics and policies in the United States. To do that, we sit down each week with journalists, scholars, filmmakers, and more to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. To help us this week, we're joined by Jay Bookman, a columnist with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Jay, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
So you write about a wide variety of issues, national politics, local politics, environmental issues. Tell us, how did you get to where you are today? How did these issues sort of fall into your bailiwick?
Well, actually, Mr. Miller and I started off in newspapers together some 40 years ago in North Adams, Massachusetts. Since then, I've worked in newspapers in Las Vegas and Washington State, and now Atlanta for the last 28 years. Fell into opinion writing because when Wayne and I first came into the business, it was right after Watergate. Everybody wanted to be a journalist. Everybody wanted to be a reporter. I had a hard time getting a writing job. But I was a copy editor and ended up, they had an opening as an opinion writer, and I raised my hand and started off down that path and never turned back.
Do you get assigned sort of as an opinion writer, a set of issues that you are going to work on for the paper, or is it that this is what you're interested in, what you're passionate about, and that's what you're going to write about?
As an editorial writer, you're assigned usually a beat of sorts. Mm-hmm. As a columnist, which I've been for, I think, 15, 20 years now, it's much more open. I write about anything that strikes my fancy, that catches my attention, that I want to study more, that I think I might have something to say. So you can pick anything you want to write as a columnist, pretty much, to cover that.
And great freedom.
But you really have specialized in politics.
Yes.
Both state and regional politics, meaning Georgia and the South, and national politics as well. And you bring a progressive perspective to your columns. How does that play in a state like Georgia, which 51% voted for the president and 49% or a little less voted for Hillary Clinton?
I've been writing columns and editorials in Atlanta for 28 years now. It's changed a lot in that time. This year, or in the 2016 election, Metro Atlanta, which is roughly half the population of the state, I think.
Is it really that much?
Yes, went for Hillary Clinton. The state as a whole went for Donald Trump, but the Atlanta metro area, for the first time, went for the Democrat. Trump carried the state because the vote outside of Atlanta was so heavily pro-Trump. Our readership now is, it didn't used to be this way, but our readership is now largely progressive as opposed to...
Really? So, but when you started a number of years ago, it was not progressive.
Wait, no.
What was it more in line with sort of the outlying regions or the areas outside metro?
There was two things going on. One was that the newspaper circulated much more widely. So you circulated throughout the state. That's no longer the case. And the other thing is that the state has gradually moved toward it's not a blue state, but it's still a red state. But at 5-10 years at the outside, I think it'll change over.
It's sort of
really?
Where Virginia was maybe 10 years ago.
I think
right?
That's exactly right. That's the model that everybody speaks to. Is we're on the same path as Virginia.
And so what does that say sort of about, you know, politics in the South and the and sort of the GOP? There are some people I know who look at, you know, the victory of Donald Trump in 2016 and say that this was a mass mobilization of people around a set of grievances, but that it was fundamentally a flawed candidate in Hillary Clinton that made his victory possible. Does that track it for Southern politics as well?
I think it does. I think it does, yes. But it's interesting. I saw, I think it was the CNN poll that just came out. The national poll said voters over 45, Trump had a 48% job approval, 48% disapproval. Voters under 45, he had a 28% approval and a 62% or disapproval. Mm. So you had a 34-point gap among voters 45 and under. You look at that as those are the voters of the future. Those of us over 45, you know, will be passing from the scene at some point.
The dustbin of history,
yes.
as it were, not to quote Trotsky again, but literally.
But you look at those numbers, that is... if I'm a Republican, I look at those numbers, and voters under 45, there's a 34-point gap.
That's a huge gap.
That's huge. And the saying used to be that as you age, you get more conservative.
Yeah.
Most of the longitudinal studies that have looked at that say that's not true, that you form your political identity young. And that becomes part of your identity, and you retain
it might
that.
Might intensify or yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That was a national poll. Yes. Was there any breakdown in terms of the South with that huge dichotomy?
I did not
in
see
age
that.
Group?
No.
Well, what would your empirical observation be?
I think in the you're seeing again what happened in Virginia, the same process. The suburbs, which had the Atlanta suburbs, have typically been very Republican.
Yes.
They are transitioning. Last year, for the first, there's two big suburban counties outside of Atlanta, Gwinnett County and Cobb County. They have been traditionally overwhelmingly Republican. This year, in 2016, they both went for Hillary Clinton. And that set shockwaves throughout the state.
So how did that happen? Was that people leaving Atlanta for the suburbs? Was it an influx of people from out of Georgia, or combination, or what were the factors that...
I think you're getting a professional class. I mean, Trump doesn't do well. He does very well among white voters without a college education.
Yeah.
Among voters with a college education, he does much less well. And those counties, Cobb County is a professional, high-income, well-educated county. Gwinnett County has become, when I first moved there in 28 years ago, it was probably 75% white. Now the schools are, white kids in the schools are just one of 20 different minorities. It's a majority-minority county now. So in Gwinnett County, it's been largely an immigration story. In Cobb County, it's been a largely...
Immigration from outside the United States.
From outside the United States, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, we want to talk about the immigration issue because it's been such a hot-button issue. But I want to talk first a little bit more about sort of what this might mean for the future of the GOP, the future of national politics. Because we used to talk about a Southern strategy, particularly for the GOP, that sort of emphasized God and guns. And is that strategy still going to work? We saw in George Bush's final campaign, we saw in Donald Trump's campaign, sort of a desire to mobilize your base, right? You find these divisive issues that are going to work, you mobilize your base more than the other side, and you're going to win. That worked in 2016. But you're talking about long-term demographic shift. That sounds like it's reshaping, you know, Southern politics.
Very much so. Very much. And I think it's inexorable. I don't know how that changes. When I first came to Atlanta, it was a Democratic state. There was a coalition of white politicians and black politicians within the Democratic Party. Over time, most of the white politicians converted to... We've had two Republican governors since I've been there. Both of them were former Democrats.
Yeah. Mm.
And it got to the point where if you wanted to have a career in politics in Georgia, regardless of what your personal feelings might be, if you went with the Republicans because that's where you had a future. If anybody, if a 25-year-old is looking to get into politics in Georgia today, and they're looking at these numbers, you've got to be kind of foolish, I think, to place your bet with the Republicans, because the trend is strong. It's going to, again, the Democrats just nominated a black female to run for governor.
Yeah.
Stacey Abrams.
Yeah.
Which is a historic event in itself. The odds are strong against her, but we'll see. In a Trump year, anything could happen. But I think in 5 or 10 years, that's, it's going to be a, and Republicans are aware of that, and they're very frightened by it.
So, you know, nationally, there are activists on the left who talk about a blue wave. Do you see signs of it in Georgia?
Yes. You've seen the state legislative districts that have been longtime Republican, that have been easily held by Republicans, have turned in special elections. So I think, yes, I mean, and again, those two big counties in Metro Atlanta that have been bastions of the Republican Party for decades, both voted in favor of Hillary Clinton this last election. So they still have Republican county commissioners, Republican sheriffs. You know, the office holders are still, but that's basically where 28 years ago, the Democrats had all those seats, but the Republicans started winning the statewide races, and then they just gradually began to filter down lower and lower into the lower offices. And I think you're about to start seeing, when the first Republican governor was elected in Georgia since Reconstruction, it was a big surprise. The next day, after his surprise victory, it was a surprise along the lines of Donald Trump's victory. Mm-hmm. That's how big a surprise it was.
Wow.
The next day, you saw 5 or 6 or 10 state legislators switch from Democratic to Republican.
Really?
Wow. And you had a Democratic legislature that quickly became a Republican legislature because of people changing parties.
Wow.
So let's move from the regional to the national. You write very frequently about the president.
Yes.
And I think it's fair to say that you're not big fan of the president. Recently, you've written about Canada. Talk to us about your take on the president and his recent actions and really dismissing of Justin Trudeau and Canada and the tariff situation as well.
It's a remarkable thing. Other folks have commented on it as well, that we have a president who insults our closest allies and embraces our longtime enemies. You know, he can't find a thing wrong to say about Vladimir Putin.
Or Kim Jong-un.
They're best buddies. He talks, you know, a very talented young man, et cetera, et cetera. You know, his people love him with a fervor, supposedly, the president says. So
what's going on with that? Why?
I don't know. I think the president has a affinity for who he perceives as strong leaders. Strong leaders being people who don't have to worry about getting elected, people who run their countries like Donald Trump runs his hotel business. So that's who he naturally gravitates toward. People who have to satisfy constituencies and voters and move incrementally as a result, he has total disdain for.
So you know, it's Democrats, little D, who make those sorts of compromise and those deals,
yes.
Right? One of the things that has sort of befuddled me is the utter silence of the national GOP in confronting what really look like deviations from long established norms of the American presidency. Evidence of the worst kinds of political corruption involving key cabinet secretaries, nepotism in the White House, you know, the employment of the president's daughter and son-in-law, despite the fact that they made $87 million last year from outside business activities. Where is the GOP? Where is Republican outrage about any of this?
Well, if you've seen the poll numbers, they tell you that the Republican support for Donald Trump is higher than it has been for any Republican president since George W. Bush in the immediate wake of 9/11. There is a lot of internal discomfort. I know I have Republican friends in Georgia who express this to me. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of internal dissent and discomfort with a lot of what Trump is doing, but zero ability or willingness to express it, because that's, you're committing political suicide. So if you look nationally, the only people who are willing to do this are, you know, Mark Sanford did it in South Carolina. Mark Sanford got defeated in the primary. Coker in Tennessee.
Not running for re-election.
He wouldn't even run. Same with Jeff Flake in Arizona. It's become, I refer to it as a cult of Trump. And you could see that I wrote that a year ago, that the party was already gravitating to becoming built around whatever, you know, the Republican Party stands for, whatever Donald Trump tweeted this morning.
And that's not the the GOP that I know, right, and that maybe I didn't agree with, but I had a certain amount of respect for, had some enduring values that it championed. Smaller government, yes, but a view of America's role in the world that goes back to Eisenhower.
Well, even the question of smaller government is no longer valid. You've got a president who wants the postal service to double the rates for Amazon. He wants to pick and choose. He wants to order utilities to burn coal. Mm-hmm. He is talking about interventions into the economy,
which have traditionally been anathema.
Be total to the anathema to the republic, to the traditional Republican, and he's pursuing these, and the party is silent. You saw a little bit of a revolt starting to take shape over the question of tariffs. You saw bills introduced in the Senate by Republicans to take, because that power, Constitution gives that power to Congress. Mm-hmm. Congress has delegated that power to set tariffs to the president. They can take that power away. But they're just not willing. Trump is far too powerful within the party to buck. The only thing that's going to change that is if the Republicans take a walloping in the midterms.
In November.
So talk about this term you use, the cult of Trump. What do you mean when, because you've used that in your columns more than once.
Yes, yes.
What do you mean by that? Describe what that is.
I think it goes back to what you were talking about. A political party adheres to certain principles. It has a philosophy that it tries to more or less abide by. And the Republican Party has had a stronger set of those philosophies and principles than the Democrats have had. Republicans have, you know, if you didn't abide by those principles, every one of them, you were a rhino.
Yeah. Yep. Small government, pro-life.
Pro-life. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Pro-guns, yep. All those things. Interestingly, the Democrats have never had, there's no such thing as a Dino.
No.
That's a good point.
Other than
Dean Martin,
that's too way back.
Flintstones, wasn't
that? Yeah, the dog.
Oh right, yeah, the Flintstone. I forgot about that.
So that there's no parallel there.
Well, and then of course there's another part of the traditional Republican Party, family values. Mm-hmm. I don't think family values has risen to the top of the agenda with the Trump administration levels.
It's a marvel that you got a three-time married, cheating with a porn star, casino-owning Manhattanite, who's embraced by evangelical leaders and as the next King David.
Why though? I mean, we've asked this question of other guests, and I still remain puzzled by this and have not really heard.
Because the fear of losing control of the country, the fear that the country is changing in ways that they can't stop and that they feel discomforted by. And that is such a great fear, so profound, and it gets back to the fact that among older Americans, Trump's strongest, that's so profound that they will accept help from anybody to stay on top. So whatever, if accepting that three times married, casino owning, cheating with a porn star president, if that's the price they have to pay for a president who says you have to stand for the national anthem, things like that, the cultural stuff, to make them feel like this is still the America I grew up in, that I feel comfortable in, that I still have my place of honor in, they are willing to do that.
One of the things that we've talked about on this show a lot is sort of like, what are the long-term pernicious consequences of the kind of divisiveness that we see in American politics right now? And, the left has issues with this too. You know, the use of words like deplorable, right? You can't criticize people who you want to vote for you.
Right.
And you can't just turn your back on voters. But, you know, in your experience, 40 years of watching politics at local, state, and national levels, have you ever seen anything like this?
No.
And how does it end?
I don't know that it does. The midterms will define a lot. But I think even if this washes through the system, and if Trump eventually leaves power, the passions that he's excited are not going to go away.
Mm. That's a good point.
Somebody else, you already see other politicians are modeling themselves after him. He's become the role model for much of the Republican Party now.
We're not going to get this genie back in the lamp, is what you're saying.
I'm starting to toy with writing a piece about how this is like the Dreyfus Affair in France back in the 1890s.
Jacques.
In which that became... for decades, for generations, that became a
litmus test.
And the French society was divided between the Dreyfusards and the anti-Dreyfusards.
Right.
They went to war with each other for decades. And it wasn't the nominal topic. Dreyfus was a military officer who was falsely accused of treason. So it's not something, but... different sides picked different, and it became a symbolic battle.
Anti-Semitism was war.
Nationalism and all these things, and Catholicism everything that's at play here: nationalism, religion, cultural change, technological change. People very uneasy. So you have the traditionalists, and so that became a dividing line for decades. And I think this will have that effect on American culture.
So we've talked a little bit today about the traditional GOP being sort of absent, right? Are they dead?
Yes. They're dead.
As a political force, as sort of the Rockefeller Republicans,
right.
That's a thing of the past.
That's a thing long of the past.
Yeah.
I tell people, because I do write a progressive column in the Deep South, and people comment on it. I tell people, and it's true, when I grew up in a military family. My father was a career military. The first vote I cast was for Gerald Ford over Jimmy Carter. I was a Republican. That's how I saw myself. But it pretty quickly became apparent to me that I didn't have a place in that. I think I see more and more often, I run a blog, I get probably several thousand comments a day on that blog.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's very, very popular.
Pro and con, I'm with you and
yes,
against you. I'm sure in a state like Georgia.
But,
yeah.
But
yes.
But it gives you if you read it every day as I have to do, it gives you a running conversation of what's going on in people's minds, and you're seeing more and more people who have been on that blog, who are regulars, have been on that blog for years, as conservatives, as Republicans, you're seeing them starting to peel away. It's happening. People are changing. We talked earlier about how political identities are hard to change. Mm-hmm. They're changing anyway. They're changing anyway.
We got about a minute left here. Handicap for us, if you would, what you expect to happen in the midterms.
I think the Democrats will take the House. I think absent.
Really?
There may be even one or two seats in Georgia that change, but other places, Virginia, Pennsylvania, there's 23 seats out there that they will be able. The Senate is much more difficult for the Democrats because most of the seats that are up this cycle are already Democratic. Yeah. But it is feasible depending on. I mean, we have seen what Donald Trump's policies are. We haven't yet seen what the consequences of those policies are. By November, we should have a better idea whether the North Korea initiative works. By November, the tariffs that are being put into place are going to start biting. So you're going to start seeing Trump is talking about shutting down the government in the fall if he doesn't get his wall.
Right.
So we've had enough time now for the policies to be put in place, but not for the ramifications to play out. I think by November, we may get it. The ramifications may begin to play out, and we'll see what happens.
Well, we will be watching with you. Jay Bookman, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, thank you so much for being with us. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Storing the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Storing the Public Square.